And we're going to talk about a couple, several women in her book, of course. And I've given you two excerpts in the handout that I gave you. And we'll mention some more things about these and other women as well in our story today. I'm going to talk about the traveling classroom. We're building a classroom building over here, and we don't want to travel with our classroom, I guess. We want it to be in one spot in our culture. But in some places and in some cultures, it's necessary to move around. And so that's an important difference. Is Ralph out? I guess he's out there. But we have a couple of visitors with us today. They were introduced in our first service, Francis Wechessa, or how do you pronounce that? Wechessa. And his wife are here, and they will speak to us tonight. And so be sure and come and hear about the progress on the program in Uganda. Okay, at the start of each of the classes, we've been looking at some of the teachings of Jesus that are important to give to those whom we are teaching and to our children, to our friends and neighbors and those we're trying to teach. And this one has an important aspect in it that fits in with the things we talked about in the last few weeks. Now, let's stand together and read out loud, recite this verse of Scripture, Matthew 7:21-23. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, in your name, and in your name drive out demons and perform many miracles. Then I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. Thank you. Please be seated. What mistake did these people make? They said, Lord, Lord. What does that imply? Remember, there was an oxymoron in the early chapters of Acts where this great sheet was let down for Peter to see and said, arise, Peter, kill and eat. And what did Peter say? Not so, Lord. That's an oxymoron. Why? If he's Lord, you'll do what he says. Isn't that what the word Lord means? Someone in control? And when the centurion talked about how he has servants, and when he tells this one do this, they do. When he says come, they come. When he says go, they go. And so when you say Lord, that implies that you're talking to someone who has all the power and authority. And so when they say Lord, but then they don't do what Jesus said, see, that's what he's, only those who do the will of my Father who is in heaven. Now, what did these people do with their religion? Notice the things that they did. They prophesied. What else? Drive out demons and perform miracles. What do you see in those that Jesus was kind of upset with, the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Herodians and so on? Because how did they practice their religion? To be seen. These are things to be seen. And so their religion was one of self-exposure and trying to make a big impression on people, performing miracles, casting out demons, and prophesying. Those are the three biggies in the public's eye, but that's not what Jesus was interested in. I never knew you means that, if you relate that to Ken's sermon this morning, they never really let the Spirit of God dwell in them, did they? Okay, so keep that in mind when you're teaching someone. That distinction may not be apparent to many people, because in our world, there are a lot of people talking religion in a public sense, but they're not practicing it. They're doing, like Jesus said, they didn't practice what they preach. Okay, now today we're talking about the traveling classroom. We do a class in here where it's comfortable and we can all sit down, but you could hold a classroom except for the PowerPoint presentation out under a tree somewhere, couldn't you? And certainly you could study these verses. I put it on the screen so that we're all reading the same version. But you could do this anywhere. It doesn't have to be in a building. It could be out on the bank of a lake, as which was the case. And Jesus, many of his sermons and lessons were delivered at the Sea of Galilee. Sometimes up in a mountain, sometimes down on a plain, sometimes in a synagogue. He could go in a building and present his lesson, or he could do it out in the open. But it traveled. Why? What was he trying to do? Talking about coverage here, isn't he? He's trying to reach all of the villages and towns in Israel. Can you imagine? Israel wasn't a big urban society, was it? Lots of little villages and towns where the farmers lived, and there were some big cities, but he did most of his work in the urban community. Jesus traveled from one town and village to another, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom of God. What was that good news? Why was it good news? It's what? It's at hand. It's here. It's important that you understand that we're on the threshold of something, and that's going to come into play in some other verses that we look at today. Now, the 12 were with him. And when you say the 12, automatically there's a word missing there. What is it? What does the 12 symbolize? The 12 apostles. Those that he had already selected at this point or were traveling with him. Now there's his classroom consists of several layers. You could almost peel them away like the peelings on an onion. At the central core are these 12. And even among them, there are three or four. Who are they? Who are closest to Jesus? Peter, James, and John, aren't they? They're sort of the inner circle, the rest of the 12, and then outside of that, he has many disciples who weren't chosen to be apostles, and we don't really know how many there are of those, but what did it take to be a disciple of Jesus? What did it take to be a disciple of John the Baptist? They followed him wherever he went. And they listened to all of his lessons, and they supported him, and they were attentive to everything that he said. And then outside his disciples, which may have numbered 50 or maybe even 100, we don't know how many, and then outside of that, there's more. Who? The crowd of people who crowded around him everywhere he went. And that amounted to how many? Thousands, didn't it? And on two occasions, he fed thousands of people. 4,000 on one occasion, 5,000 on another occasion. So he had big audiences listening to everything he said, but it comes in his classroom, consists of his permanent students that he selected that are his disciples, and among those, the apostles that he sends out on occasion to do the work. He sends them into the villages to preach, places where he hasn't gone, perhaps. And then outside of that are all of the people auditing the things that he's saying. And so it's a big operation. I mean, he's got thousands of students, some disciples. What's the difference between a student and a disciple? Are they the same thing? Yeah, the students want to know what Jesus is teaching. They're interested in understanding his teachings. The disciples, what do they want? They want to be just like him. The disciples have, in the context of what we're talking about here, the disciples want to learn not only just about Jesus, but learn how to be like Jesus. And in that context, we're going to emphasize that in the last half of this class, that it's more than just learning about Jesus and learning what he taught It's learning how to be what He is. And that fits in with what Ken taught us this morning. The Spirit dwelling within us does what? It metamorphoses. It transforms us. It makes us just like Jesus. So that's the goal. Okay, the 12 were with Him. Also some women who had been cured of evil spirits and diseases. Now, among those who were following Him, they're not apostles, but they're definitely disciples. And they want to be like Him, and they want to help Him in every way they can. Some women, let's notice who they are. Mary Magdalene, from whom 7 demons had come out. Can you imagine? We don't know the story of how that happened, do we? I mean, it isn't detailed in there. We're just told that that's something that had happened. But that we know that there was the man infested with demons called Legion that were driven out into the pigs. A legion is a huge number of demons in those people, and one or two who were infested with Legion. And here's a woman infested, and I say infested, that's a technical term, of course, infected or infested with 7 demons. Now, Jesus told a story once about a man who had a demon, and the demon was cast out, and he swept and cleaned the place, you recall. And then the demon couldn't find any place to live, and what did he do? Brought his friends and came back, found the house cleaned and swept out and everything in order, and he went right back in, didn't he? So multiple demons in a person, can you imagine? Do we have anything in our society like that, do you think? Do demons still infest people? Do they? In some parts of the world, do we get that impression? Are demons still causing disease in humanity? Jesus came, it says in 1 John, Jesus came to destroy the works of the devil. Now, I think that when the demon possession, in the sense that they had it in New Testament times, it may still be possible in people who live a lifestyle that allows that sort of thing to happen. But in a Christian environment, it's easily possible that Christ prevents that sort of thing from infesting us. I don't know, that's a mysterious kind of an area, and I don't know the details of it. But in His day and age, it's clear that some of the diseases that Jesus cured were caused by demons. And some of them were simply diseases. But keep in mind that when God made the world, there weren't any diseases in Adam and Eve. And that's something that the devil introduced along the way in human history. And so disease itself came from Satan. And if demons are associated with disease, then that makes it even worse. A question back here. Yeah, well, I don't know. It's an ambiguous kind of situation. We aren't really told the details of it. But what you're saying is that the demons, it was a visible effect when Jesus cast them out and they were cured. Yeah, and we don't cast out demons in our culture, but in some cultures they seem to be able to do something, and I don't know. That's another class. We'll do that one in the summer or something, okay? But anyway, Mary Magdalene, why do you suppose she followed this man and his classroom? What would be her motive, having been cured? Pardon me? She was grateful for having been healed. Right. I think that's perfectly natural for her to be very, very interested in what this person had to say. Now, there have been books written that suggest more things going on between Jesus and Mary, but there's no hint of that in the Gospels at all. Now, Joanna, the wife of Cusa. That's another interesting one. I gave her a little snippet of her story in your handout. And Cusa now is the manager of Herod's household. Can you imagine? This is Herod Antipas, Herod the Tetrarch. This isn't Madman Herod, Herod the Great, that we talked about, who was there when Jesus was born. There have been several Herods down to this point in time. This particular Herod was, however, just as ugly and politically mean as his ancestors were. But the steward of his household, can you imagine that would be a prestigious position to hold? And probably paid well. And so she was a woman of means, the wife of Cusa. And yet she had been cured too. You see it said back there, women who had been cured of evil spirits and diseases, she had been cured of something, and she was grateful, followed along with it, with Jesus and his classroom, and the manager, Susanna. Now, we don't know a lot about Susanna, and many others. These women were helping to support them. Who's them? Jesus and his apostles and disciples, out of their own means. Do you suppose there were any men who helped support Jesus' ministry out of their means? Or maybe only through their women? Now, this is a culture in which women are somewhat enabled, but certainly not as free as women in our society. And maybe some women in our society feel like they're still persecuted, but actually we see Eastern societies in the news all the time and know the restrictions that are placed on women, and that was true of Israel's society as well. Things women couldn't do, places women couldn't go. When we talked about the woman at the well in Samaria, we saw that explained to us that there were things women didn't talk to men in the middle of the day out in public. And so, and much less a Samaritan woman talking to a Jew. So there were these taboos about these sorts of things. But Jesus welcomed the women in his group. That's unusual. I doubt if any of the other rabbis did that. That was most unusual. Now, if you go over toward in Matthew at the time of the crucifixion, you find that these women were still with him. They had come out of Galilee to Jerusalem and stood by while he was crucified, and this same comment is placed there. I think it's Matthew 27, that they had supported them out of their means. I mean, they stayed with them. And I'm sure it wasn't cheap. They talked about their needs when they fed the 5,000. Remember, said, where will we get the money to feed so many people? Well, money was needed to buy food. And so there's a lot of routine expenses associated with a group like this. They normally didn't have to feed the whole crowd, but they would have to feed the 12 and many of the disciples that were there. And so it wasn't cheap, you know. And some occasions we see Jesus and just the 12. And of course, Jesus was very popular in his first year. And after he had said some things that offended some of the Jews, then the crowds fell off. And he was left with the 12 and maybe some more disciples who followed along. But initially, it was an expensive proposition. All right, so let's see about some of these women. In particular, two that you know of that are relatively famous, and we read that and we think of them as being hospitable, but they're also disciples. They came to the village where a woman named Martha opened her home to him. Now, this home is where Martha and Mary and Lazarus live. Right, we see that in the raising of Lazarus later on, we see them in this same grouping. She had a sister called Mary who sat at the Lord's feet listening to what he said. And that's the phrase I want you to get out of this. Sitting at the feet of a rabbi meant what? What would you imagine? Paul talked about, I think it's in Acts 22, where he talked about the fact of his credentials. He's making his defense to the Jewish people. He's been captured and threatened with death, but he's making a defense to them. He says, "Now I've studied at the feet of Gamaliel." In the NIV, it softens that a bit, said I was a student of Gamaliel, but the Greek words are actually sat at the feet of Gamaliel. Gamaliel was another rabbi, and Paul was his student. And you remember when Stephen was stoned, Paul wasn't old enough to do the stoning, but he held the clothes of those who threw the rocks. So here's another young man. We've been talking about the fact, we've ignored the fact that there are these young people around Jesus. The apostles, Peter's the only apostle over 20 years of age. All of the others are very young. And we talked about the reasons for that, for believing that that's the case. And why do you suppose it is that we have always assumed that the apostles were older men? And I've been thinking about that, and I think the reason is the word apostle. We haven't understood what that meant. We see later on the authority of the apostles in the New Testament. They had authority too, didn't they? Authority had been given to them by Jesus. And they made decisions and they met and issued in the 15th chapter of Acts, they issued their decision about certain problems that arose in the church. The word apostle to us has come to mean authority. And where do we place authority? Not in teenagers, but in older people. And so we sort of twist that and we think that the apostles are older men, but they're not. I think I've shown you clearly, and we'll see another case here where it's obvious that they're not really grown men. Some of these women are following Jesus, the mothers of some of these young men. And they're helping they're watching after their young people. Yes. They're not teenagers anymore by Acts 15, that's right. Later on, they are. But at the start, they were. And Jesus began his teaching program and picked the 12 to be young people that would give them the longest lifespan, of course, naturally. But nonetheless, that's the way the classroom was set up. The rabbi selected young men, age 15 to 18 usually, to be his disciples. The ones he called. Now there's another point we ought to make here. We see the call of how many of the 12 disciples? Well, we know Peter and Andrew, James and John. Who else? Well, Philip shows up in there, and Nathaniel, and then one more. Matthew. Yeah, we see the call of 7 of the 12. What about the other 5? They're not important enough to mention. Probably the other 5 were volunteer disciples whom, after they had been there among Jesus' followers for a time when Jesus prayed all night and then selected the 12, he picked some of those others that he hadn't really called specifically beforehand. So some of them may have been volunteer disciples, some of them were the ones that he had hand-picked. So here are these. And we saw how that Peter and Andrew, James and John, fishing, dropped everything and followed Jesus when he came by and said, "Follow me," and left the business to Father and servants who were in the boat. The operation didn't depend specifically on them and all of the goods that they were using, their boats and fishing gear and nets and everything, weren't just left on the land. These are youngsters, and the parents were anxious for them to be disciples of Jesus. But some of the mothers went along with them. Now, can you women, can you kind of follow that emotion? Here my two boys are going out, one's 17, one's 15. They're going out with this man, and it's a wild, wild world out there. And they kind of follow along to make sure that everything's okay. And they they get caught up in this thing. Now, these aren't women who necessarily have been healed of anything, but because of their intrinsic interest in their own children, they went along to see what was happening, and they got enthralled with the whole story, the whole ministry, and stayed with it right through 3.5 years to the end. Now, that tells you there were families who could do that. Probably not every family could afford to have the woman do that. But if these were the only children they had, then that two sons, that might be something that they could do, and the father back home continue working in whatever the family business was. Okay, well, you know the rest of the story. You've heard that sermon many times about Martha complaining that Mary wasn't helping her with the homework. So we won't dwell on that. Now, I want to spend some time on this particular one. The mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and, kneeling down, asked a favor of him. So here's the mother and her two sons, which picture them not as grown men, but as teenagers. And they kneel down. "What is it you want?" Jesus asked. She said, "Grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom." What do you suppose motivated her to ask this favor? Huh? Well, she's proud of them. But what about sitting at the right and left? What's that implying? Well, it has to do with their prestige, but there's something else. And when you read this story, yes? No, oh, no, no, not the sheep and the goats, no. Okay, but what I want you to see here in this story is that, taken in context, there's some more information. What had gone on just before she comes with this request? Now, as you read these Gospels, and I'm still encouraging you to do that. I'm on my second round, too. Irwin isn't the only one. Okay, so. But he's a little ahead of me. I'm going to have to do some reading. Okay. But as you read this, look at the context. Look how it's linked to what went before. What just went before this was Jesus talking about the fact he's going to Jerusalem, he's going to be crucified, he's going to die at the hands of the Jews and be raised again. Well, that adds a little bit. They're on their way back to Jerusalem now. Now, that adds a little bit of urgency to her request. I need to get this request in before that happens, because that's evidently going to precipitate everything, isn't it? And the new kingdom, the kingdom of God is at hand. The new kingdom is going to be instituted, and I want to be sure that my boys get a good position. But there's something beyond that. If this is in the 20th chapter of Matthew, if you go back to the end of the 19th chapter of Matthew, you find a question there that was answered when they ask him, what'll we get if we have left everything and follow you? And he said, to the apostles, you will do what? Anybody with your books open there? Sit on what? 12 thrones. Aha. Uh-huh. You're going to sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Well, and that had just happened. And then he says, it's coming to an end. There's going to be the crucifixion and the death and the resurrection in Jerusalem soon. Well, she better get her request in. You can see how her mind is working here. But did she instigate this, or did the boys? Well, if you read these Gospels, you find that there were several occasions in which they got to arguing about what? Who's the greatest? And so where you sit says something about how great you are. Question.
But she must have walked away before chapter 19:30.
Yeah, that must have been a real question, isn't it? That he's going to answer that when he answers her in a minute. Okay? So here's the question. It's brought up because of the context. And when you read these Gospels, keep the context in mind as you go along. Try to tie things together because it makes an important difference in how well you understand it. All right. Don't you know? You don't know what you're asking, Jesus said to them. Can you drink the cup I'm going to drink? And the boys said, we can. Well, now that has to do with what just came before. I'm going to go to Jerusalem. I'm going to be arrested. I'm going to die. I'm going to be resurrected. Can you do all that? Well, you see other occasions as you read through here where Peter and the others say, if we have to, we'll die with you. They got ready to go back to Jerusalem to the raising of Lazarus, and they said, well, why do you want to go back there? They want to kill you. But they said, okay, they were resigned to the fact that if we go back and we're all dead, then that's that. Jesus said to them, you will indeed drink from my cup. So they're going to suffer like he is. And who are the two sons? Peter and James. Think about what happened. James and John. Yeah, good. Okay. I saw some heads turn. That's some heads shake. No. Okay, you're listening. That's great. James and John. That was a test. Yeah, just a slip. Okay. Who was the first of the apostles to die a martyr's death? It's James. Who was the last of the apostles? John. And so you see, they sort of bracket this whole thing. If you imagine Jesus and his throne and then the 12 thrones around and the order in which they die, here's James on one side and John on the other. They may have got their wish. I don't really know. But he said, who's going to determine the order and where they sit on these thrones? God's going to determine it. It's been determined ahead of time, and I can't. These places belong to those for whom they've been prepared by my Father. All right. We don't know that this woman's name was Salome, but it is inferred by the fact that in the listings of the women, they either say the mother of James and John, or if they don't say that, they say Salome. And most people, most authorities think that that's who it is. And that's who I gave you in the handout there. You can read all the details of it. It's kind of interesting that the guy Cusa, it's Chusa in the King James Version with an H in there, that he may have been the nobleman who's Jesus healed his son, or he may have been one of the individuals. He may too have been very impressed with Jesus. And Herod, listening to all of this discussion among his servants, was quite interested in what happened when he thought that John the Baptist had been resurrected again. And so he heard them all talking about it. He wanted to see Jesus. And that was one of the things that came up during the trials. Yes, Flo? They didn't know what that meant. You're right. No, they didn't know exactly what that entailed. But of course, it sounded innocent enough. Just drink from the cup that I drink from. But it eventually dawned on them what all of that meant, of course. All right. When the 10 heard about this, they were indignant with the brothers. Jesus called them together and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lorded over them and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be your slave. First, you see, he had talked about, someone mentioned it a while ago, first and the last. That was that discussion back at the end of the 19th chapter. And so it's the first shall be last, the last shall be first. In fact, it's not going to make much difference, is it, if everybody's equal? And that's kind of what the implication is. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. So, So he goes on and explains this. He has to explain greatness in his kingdom a number of times. And as you read those passages, notice the differences between them. Okay, we got just about five more minutes. I want to talk a little bit about the classroom itself. What's being taught? Matthew 5 is what we call Sermon on the Mount. Okay, you're with me here. When he saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside. Now, at the end of Matthew 4, we have a verse kind of like the one you'll see in a minute, where there were crowds, there were lots of people, and they wanted to hear him teach. So he went up on a mountainside, sat down, his disciples came to him, and he began to teach them. Of course, his disciples are his primary target here, but everybody else can overhear it. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed, and he goes on with how many blessings? There's a whole list of them, aren't there? Now there's another passage that you run across in Luke that looks very, very similar. What we call the Beatitudes down at the bottom of the slide here. And the interesting thing about it is, he went down with them, the apostles, and stood on a level place. A large crowd of his disciples were there, and a great number of people from all over Judea, from Jerusalem, from the seacoasts of Tyre and Sidon. He was attracting people from the Gentiles, you see, as well. Tyre and Sidon are not in Israel. Who had come to hear him and to be healed of their diseases. Of course, that's a motivation. Those troubled by evil spirits were cured. The people were all tried to touch him because power was coming from him and healing them all. Looking at his disciples, he said, now that's the apostles plus the inner circle around him of students. Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who hunger now, for you will be satisfied. And he goes on with another set of Beatitudes that are almost, but not quite the same, and not quite in the same order. And that bothers some people. Have you thought about that? Is this the same occasion? Now see, critics look at this and say, well, one version has it this way, another version has it that way. You can't trust it. But the version in Matthew happens before the selection of the apostles. This happens in Luke right after the selection of the apostles. Why is Jesus teaching the same thing twice? Well, it's the nature of a traveling classroom. He's going from village to village and town to town and teaching this. He's teaching much the same thing everywhere he goes. His major theme is what? The kingdom of heaven is at hand, and maybe repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. He teaches that everywhere. His apostles get multiple doses of the same lessons. Is that good? Does repetition hurt anything? No, not really. And so he has sermons, and he teaches the same thing. But Ken, when you preach in second service, will it be exactly like at first service? No, it'll be a little different. Why? Well, it's hard to, you'd have to read it to make it the same when you repeat a lesson. And so the lesson is repeated, and the different, what you call them, the parables. Yeah, the parables are different sometimes. Sometimes the parables are similar. But for each setting, he has a set sermon maybe and a bunch of variations on it. And there's only so many ways you can teach it. So it's repeated. Keep that in mind. And of course, when you look at the context, which is so important, you see that what's in Luke is in a different time, a different place, a different group. And so it has some similarities to the first one, but he'll change it a little bit to fit whatever the circumstances are. And he knows more about that crowd than they ever suspect. And so he tailors his lesson to fit the group that he's teaching. And he does it hundreds of times. There's lots of villages. You look at that map I gave you a few weeks ago, and And there's a bunch of them. And you only have the major towns listed on there, and there's little villages all in between. And he goes to their synagogues and he teaches these things over and over and over. Okay, we're through this morning. I want you to have a feel for what's going on here. And I think we've covered most of the details. But Jesus' mission is to get this information everywhere. And so he goes from place to place. Now he's going to teach in synagogues. We'll talk about that a little bit next week, where the crowd is more limited. And you can't get everybody in some of these places, and that happens too. He goes and everybody crowds around him for healing and everything, and the crush of the crowd is so great that you can't get to him anymore. But he's very popular in the beginning of his teachings. And so this traveling classroom is an interesting story. We have a new building that will hold our classrooms. Is it wrong then to spend money to build a building to teach in? You worry about the fact that we have to spend a lot of money to put that building up. But on the other hand, we use it a lot and use it effectively. Pardon me? He taught in the synagogues too. They were put up there as classrooms. And they met in the synagogues on the weekends. We talked about that before. The kids came to the synagogues for education all through the week. We need to use our building space. That makes it worthwhile if we do it. And in our society, it would be difficult to do teaching anywhere else. But this should be open for our use within a month, and we had hoped it would be ready here in the middle of this month. It's apparently, the story I hear is it's a little bit behind schedule because of the holidays and everything. They couldn't get some supplies they needed. But it'll be ready soon enough, and we'll use that in teaching in fixed classrooms, but it's still the same story. It has to go out, has to be taught, we have to collect the crowds to us. Any comments or questions about today? Do you get a feel for what we have in Jesus' teaching mission? All right, well, thank you very much. We'll see you next week.